And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 20th, 2020. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well, and I'm excited to be talking about some big picture issues we're going to examine today. Climate reparations versus climate colonialism. Spoiler alert, we choose climate reparations.
So Mariah, climate news comes in all shapes and sizes, and this week is kind of a big bite, a heavy-duty thing to think about that I think is, I hope that we can break down into something a little bit more palatable, shall we say, or digestible, maybe is the right way to put it, because as climate activists, it's good to be thinking about bigger picture issues. I mean, really big picture issues. And also to, it's good to kind of be ahead of the curve. I think that as you listen to our discussion tonight, you may be hearing words that might come back, or at least concepts that might come back to us as we go into the next decades. And the article that we wanted to talk about was actually published in Foreign Policy magazine. Yes, foreignpolicy.com, which of course is where, you know, Henry Kissinger published various kinds of articles, right? That are, as we say, oftentimes pretty thick because it's about foreign policy of the United States. But this is an interesting one, and it has to do with the idea of the title is The Case for Climate Reparations by a professor at Georgetown. But the article is really thought-provoking on a bunch of levels. Let me, Mariah, lay out the top, what I consider the top-level idea in this article, and then we can maybe drill down a little bit more. I think it's a commonplace among climate activists that the poor of the world are going to get hurt first, right? And we already see that happening. In fact, one of the things we ought to be talking about is the fact that Hurricane Eta at Category 5 just went through Central America, and a couple days later, Iota went essentially the same path that Hurricane Category 5. Right? There are bad things happening to the people around the world who least deserve that. The case that's made in this article is that there is a choice for the world going forward. One choice is the good choice, is that the world, we should essentially recognize our common humanity and work out how best to survive as a species in common. And the other choice in front of us is what the article calls climate colonialism, which is essentially this idea that the well-to-do, that is to say people in the United States, people in the developed West, will basically pull up the drawbridges, abandon the rest of the world, basically sacrifice the rest of the planet to suffering. And those two choices are real. I think that we're facing those. And the article goes on to say, once you accept that this is kind of the choice that the planet and the species is facing between collaboration or basically cutting off most of humanity, saying that existing tools of international relations, of the negotiations, of relying on cooperation, relying on goodwill, none of that seems to be working and is unlikely to work, and that we need to be rethinking how we deal with the issue of climate. So, Mariah, not to put you on the spot, let me stop there. Do you have any comment on what I've said so far that kind of walk our way through?
I think it's a great summary. I think the words that he used was the climate reparations, which is when we are addressing it in a way that helps solve some of the inequalities and the problems created by the climate or exacerbated by the climate crisis, and gives us that way, that collaborative way out of the climate catastrophe, as you mentioned, by tackling both the mitigation and the migration of the refugees that will inevitably come from the problems associated with climate change. And then the other way, you mentioned there are two ways forward. The first is climate reparations. The second is climate colonialism. And that's the, I think you said that, that's the survival of the wealthiest and devastation for the world's most vulnerable. And one of the other terms they talk about is sort of this idea of eco-apartheid, which I've heard floated about for the past two decades. I think Van Jones was one of the first people I heard say it. But the idea of, you know, you have a certain this split between those who have and who have not, and some will survive and others will not. And it, that's an ugly alternative. And I think it's important to note that, you know, even so, sure, we're among the wealthiest country. The United States is a wealthy country, right? But it doesn't mean that, you know, by locking our borders, we're going to stay whole, right? There's, you know, there's still, all of that is still going to affect us. So that climate colonialism isn't sort of like, well, at least we'll be okay. I mean, not that that's, you know, in any way a good thing, but it's, that's not even how it will be, because all those, the follow-on effects from that, that apartheid is, that hurts everyone. So there's just no choice there. But there is a choice, unfortunately, right?
Well, I think that an unexamined choice is one that is a bad deal. The as I said, the authors talk about the what they call the tools of international relations, and they point to things like the commonly accepted fact that corporations seek profit, right? Which, and of course, those corporations are like Exxon, right? The fossil fuel industry seeking profit. That's all blessed and much, much admired in the West, right? But that turns into an extractive, destructive process, you know, in other parts of the world. And that,
and should,
the,
to put a finer point on it, the short-term profits are really the biggest problem, right? It's this, you know, right, short-term gain versus long-term effect without externalities incorporated.
And often those sort of that corporate greed is linked up with the governments that seek security. So again, international relations, all governments want to seek security. The most powerful ones get to bigfoot everyone else. The United States will guarantee that its ships can go through the Suez Canal, yada, 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 all that kind of stuff. So there are tools, the mechanisms by which the world is negotiating things and working stuff out are not really serving the greater purpose, because, as he says, all this cooperation and goodwill have not, even before Trump came along, the poorest of the world were being abused under the climate regime, right? And they were taking it on the chin, and so what the author goes on to talk about, and to my reading of the article, can be read a lot of ways, the author comes to focus on the refugee problem as a sort of microcosm and proxy, as a lens at which to look at the kinds of things that will happen if the climate colonialism path is taken, right? Is that the current state of affairs, even before you get to the 140 million climate refugees that will be displaced over the next decades, you've already got refugees from wars and all kinds of stuff. What does the West do now? The West sets up a camp wherever you want, you know, pick your, you know, your place in the world. There's a huge camp of hundreds of thousands of people living in squalor outside of a major city. And the West congratulates itself for having set up this camp and providing some minimal food aid, and thinks it's done, washes its hands and walks away. Right? And if that's the model for when the 140 million people that are displaced by climate, when they come along, we're going to put all those 140 million people in squatter camps outside of Mumbai, or if Mumbai is still above water, right? That's a bad path forward. Right? That's just not a place we want to go. And the West thinks it's the right way. I mean, I say the West, right? Sort of basically sort of the United States, Europe. These refugee camps have been completely acceptable. And as the article says, the existence of the camps shield countries like the United States from an influx of refugees. It makes you feel morally superior that you provided some aid, and look at those poor people over there. Isn't that a shame? So I'll stop there. Mariah, tell me, is that in the ballpark?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really sad, sad sort of status of affairs, right? To have these refugee camps being set up in the way that they're being treated. And it's not just here, it's all over the world. And we're creating the problem and then not helping those who it affects the most. And it's really tragic. And it's not a way forward. It's just not. I mean,
as I say, especially given the fact that this system is already choked and bad, just in quotation mark, with refugees from existing wars, right? And it hasn't even begun, like the massive, like when Bangladesh gets flooded, right? And there's millions of people on the move, right? And if the only tool we have is a refugee camp, that's what I think what the article is saying. If that's our tool, it's not a good it's not a good way to go.
I think it's important too to sort of clarify what this author means by climate reparations. I think he talks about how the term reparations refers to making amends and connotes sort of, you know, cash transfers or apologies, and that's not the case here. That's not how he's using the term here. He's using it to say a systemic approach to redistributing resources and changing policies and institutions that have perpetuated harm. So not giving money, but changing policies and supporting and helping folks by giving them what the access to, you know, food, water, shelter that will lift them up.
I thought there was a phrase in here that I really liked. Let me see if I can find it. I think it's resiliency capacity, right? And the article says that the West needs to recognize that through its unjust and unjust processes to date, we've left many parts of the world without the capacity to be resilient under climate change. Right, so they have no way to bounce back when they get hit by this stuff, and the West needs to recognize that that's part of a long-term historical exploitation that has happened. And the word socialist gets bounced around too much, but when you start thinking of world history from that perspective, you can see that there are reasons that the global South is less resilient, and the West needs to recognize that and accept it. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree that the term reparation in the United States has lots of discussion around that term here in the United States in its own right, right? But this is a different kind of thing. This is transfer of expertise, money, and skill to these other places to make up for what has gone before and to build them up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and so basically that's the argument, is in the mechanism. The author makes the case that the mechanism exists in the climate fund that was set up under the Paris Accord, right? Well, back to the Paris Accord, another continuing theme in our conversations. But evidently under the Paris Accord, the idea was that there would be $100 billion a year transfer to the global South, right, to help react and build the infrastructure that's needed. And as of now, 5 or 6 years after the Paris Accords were signed, I think it's been something like $6 billion in total over 5 years. So, I mean, the mechanism is there, but the funding of it is not real. I think a couple of shows ago, we talked about Joe Biden returning to the Paris Accord, and they're going to put another $2 billion into this fund, which is great, but not nearly what is really called for. I mean, I think it is a big deal.
Yeah. And I think the author also talks about sort of reframing how we look at our help and support of these countries where that are going to be underwater and have a lot of refugees coming from them. And so he said, you know, reframe it so that you look at it as contributing to a system that structurally prevents the majority of refugees from finding refuge. And it when you reframe it that way, it becomes an obligation rather than an act of charity. So it no longer becomes this like, look at us, aren't we nice? We gave them a really small dirty bed to stay on, right? It you know, becomes this sort of, okay, this is we are beholden to this. We need to make this happen. It's good for all of us if we take care of this and manage this well. And it becomes something that we are more beholden to.
Yeah, I think that the West, as you say, needs to look in the mirror and reverse its, I would say, somewhat self-congratulatory path here and recognize that we're denying these people refuge. And that is a moral obligation. And I mean, I would say that this whole question of, so it's interesting. I mean, Mariah, we've talked lots about, the changes that are coming in the future, right? I mean, the idea of a moral requirement in foreign policy may be something that returns to the front. And just as I'm speaking, this goes a little bit far off the topic, but certainly the British Empire thought that it had a moral duty to bring Western civilization to the rest of the world, right? I mean, how did that work out for everybody with Rudyard Kipling and Gunga Din, right? Not so good. But on the other hand, introducing some kind of imperative recognition of our common humanity across the world would be, would be a salient, not salient, would be a good thing for foreign policy to have as a component. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Well, so we should put it down there. This is quite an interesting article. We'll put up the link to it. It is thought-provoking. It's actually a pretty good read. I mean, I was making jokes about slogging through foreign policy magazines, but it's not that thick. And it is topics that are most people are familiar with. And so it's a good read, and it stretches your brain a little bit. And I think that's a good thing, right? We climate hawks have to go from, what is a Perscovite solar cell and how are we going to get battery storage in a to the moral implications of what we're talking about. I mean, it's a great job, right?
It's a good place to be.
All right. Well, look, there you go, Mariah. I will put up the link in the blog. In the blog, of course, is at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you read this article and have questions or answers, I mean, as you peruse it, let me just say that we could easily have misunderstood some of these points. And so if you read it and we think we've missed something, please let us know. Send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. We'd love to hear from you. Of course, you can listen to the smartphone on any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask your friends to listen to it on their modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support that keeps pointing us in the right direction week after week, D.R. We really appreciate it. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thank you for thinking big.
Ah, always fun.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.